the CDSFA Community Football Podcast. Hello, I'm Gilbert Lourquet, and welcome to episode 24 of the CDSFA Community Football Podcast. Today we speak with Peter Katholos. Once described by legendary Real Madrid and Hungarian player Ferenc Puskas as the best technical player in Australia, Peter was born in the Greek village of Mycenae in the Peloponnese. He migrated to Sydney with his family at the age of 9 and started playing football in the CDSFA for Canterbury Junior Football Club. Peter went on to have an illustrious playing career, spanning 14 years in the National Soccer League, playing for St George, Sydney Olympic, Apia Leichhardt, Marconi and Parramatta, winning 3 NSL championships, 2 NSL Cups and being voted Australian Football of the Year in 1982. Peter wore the green and gold on 22 occasions between 1981 and 1983, including a man of the match performance versus England at the SCG. He also had a stint in the Greek First Division with Larissa. Peter was coached by the greats Tommy Docherty, Bertie Mariani and Rally Rasic. Peter reunited with the CDSFA later on, playing for Belmore Eagles in the over 45s men's competition. He's also volunteered as an under-8s coach for the Earlwood Wanderers Football Club. Nicknamed the Cat, Peter has lived in the district for 50 years. He is now a member of the Football Heritage Committee and is also on a mission to transform the coaching culture in Australia. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Well, thanks very much, Peter, for joining us on the Community Football Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Gilbert. Long overdue, but I'm here.
Yes, it is long overdue. We tried to get you at the start, but here we are.
You're right. You did try to get me, and I do apologise. So I'll take that back.
No, fantastic. Peter, you've had a long history with the association. You want to tell us, first of all, your first junior club?
Mate, I played for the Canterbury Juniors, yeah. Under 15 and under 16s, with Vince Laws.
Yeah, he's still Vince alive. Laws. He's still there.
And, I've sent him my regards. Yeah. At Lees Park, yeah. back in the day.
Yeah.
So yeah, I played a couple of years, and it was really, really good. I mean, I've lived in the area all my life, so I'm part of the Canterbury District Association fabric.
Yeah, fantastic. Where did you grow up, Peter?
I grew up in Campsie.
Campsie, yeah, local.
Campsie,
yeah, local,
yeah. And Campsie, 30 Amacoon, just down the road, and then to Earlwood. I was at Earlwood, and then now I'm at Belmore. So
yeah,
this area has been my home.
Fantastic. Do you remember your first coach? Do you remember the name of your first coach?
Take you back a bit. I do. I remember my coach at Canterbury was Walter Tamandel.
There we go.
Walter Tamandel was one of the greatest players, imports that came to this country. And I remember he took over our juniors. Like he was he was coaching us young players. And that's how I got my break, because I went from under 16 juniors association football,
yeah,
to playing for Canterbury Marrickville first grade.
That was a big one back then, yeah.
And from 1976, back in 1976 to 97 playing first grade. So that was that was my transition.
Fantastic. Do you remember your first mentor?
Mentor, that's a good question. Didn't really have anyone. I sort of had to work it out. But look, Raul Blanco was my first coach that I really, I looked up to, and he inspired me. You know, his technique, his skill, because he was a great footballer.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, I had him at St George, but I used to, we used to train together at back in the day at Marrickville Golf Course.
Yeah.
So, yeah, probably Raul Blanco.
Right. What are the key lessons you think he taught you that you thought, okay, you certainly used in your career?
I suppose about discipline.
Discipline.
Discipline as a footballer. You know, I remember when he was coach, you know, we had to, you know, be on time and, you know, wear, you know, be shaven.
Yeah.
You know, socks are up. You know, all those things. So
yeah,
I think you know, as young players, we don't sort of have the, we probably didn't have that sort of ethic.
Mm.
So he installed things like that, which I, you know, I took on for the rest of my coaching career.
Fantastic.
Soccer career, sorry.
Beautiful. Can you remember the earliest or earliest recollection of playing or watching or following football?
Look, I watched Sydney Olympic at Wimbledon Park, which those days was Panhellenic.
Yeah.
I remember watching a couple of games at Wentworth Park. But look, for me, it was, you know, I was a young kid. My parents were not really soccer followers.
Oh, they weren't. No, oh, right.
They weren't. No. So wow. We didn't sort of. I didn't travel to.
Yeah.
To go and watch Panhellenic or.
Well, wow, that's games. Interesting. Okay. All right. And what part of Greece your parents?
I grew up in. I was born in Mycenae Lekina, yep. Which is one of the villages, and then I grew up in Athens, playing in the streets, I love football from an early age.
Yeah. Do you remember the first jersey that you obviously wore or followed or purchased? Do you remember that one?
Mate, I tell you the truth, my parents didn't have enough money to buy me.
Is that right?
They didn't have enough money to buy me a soccer ball. I remember
really
crying back in the days.
Is that right?
And my mum, you know, bought me a plastic soccer ball.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about poverty.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why we came to Australia because, you know, we were poor. My parents migrated to Australia to give us a better future.
Beautiful. Footballers that made you fall in love with the game.
Well, back in the day when I was growing up, there was a few Greek soccer players that I used to listen on the radio because there was no TV back in the day.
Yeah.
That's how far
back we go. Yeah.
But guys like, you know, Veligadis and Sideris and these guys, you know, don't know, but these guys were superstars of Greek football back then. So that was my first players that I looked up to.
Yeah.
Until I came to Australia and we started growing up, and then I started watching, you know, World Cup and Johan Cruyff and Johan Cruyff I admired, and then Pelé and guys like that.
Your favourite football team? I'm sure you've had a few,
My favourite football team that I follow when in England is Arsenal.
Arsenal, the Gunners.
Yeah, the Gunners, because. I nearly signed for Arsenal back in 1981.
Really?
Yeah. I was offered a contract, and unfortunately, under Terry Neill, I couldn't go there because of migration laws back in the day. I wasn't an English citizen.
You had a permit.
There was no Euro passport.
No.
So unfortunately, I had to continue in Australia.
Wow. And so you still follow them now?
I still do. I still do.
Better times ahead?
Hopefully, yes.
You played for Canterbury Juniors, you mentioned that, but also I've noticed in your notes you sort of passed over to us, you've coached obviously within the district as well, Elwood Wanderers.
I did. I coached Elwood Wanderers under eights at one stage, and, you know, when my son started playing soccer, so that was my associations, just like we're volunteer dads, and
absolutely, all of a sudden
there was no coaches, and, you know, Peter, can you please coach the team? And you know, what am I going to say? So I did that, and I enjoyed it, and then, you know, I saw a picture the other day of all these kids and where they've grown up to and become men.
Yeah, tell us about everyone talks about pathways nowadays. You know, how do you go from a junior club to whether it be, you know, NPL or whether it be, you know, a state league or ultimately overseas. Just tell us your journey from a junior club. How do you then get promoted?
Look, the problem these days, I think back in the day, I think young players were given more opportunities.
Right.
Yeah, well, I played first grade at 17. 17 years old, I was playing first grade. I was playing against Addie Abonnie at Garside Park. It's like, are you kidding me? And the year before, I was playing association football with Canterbury.
Wow.
So you know, that opportunity, I look back and I'm going, that is huge. And how many players these days get that opportunity?
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen. You know, we think these days that the player's got to be 20, 21 to be ready, 22.
Mm.
Well, that's too late. You know, he should be blooded, you know, 18, 19. He should be first grade material if he's good enough, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough – I think the coaches are too they don't want to gamble with young players. Everything's about results driven, and some of them don't want to gamble with these young players.
Mm. Now, you were described by the legendary Ferenc Puskas as the best technical player in Australia. Right? How did you, just in your own words and your experience, how did you get to that level? Of being recognised as quite a technical player.
I got to tell you, that was an absolute huge moment for me to be told that by one of the greatest players in world football.
Mm.
It's huge. You know, I'm an Australian player. I'm an Australian product, really. And to be given that accolade was huge. But look, how did I get there?
Mm.
And to become that? I, Gilbert, spent so many hours, you know, practising and playing football. I just loved it. I did it with so much passion. Somebody asked me the other day, I went to school. I played in the morning before school.
Yeah.
I played at playtime. I played at lunchtime. I played after school. And then I went to club training.
All day long.
Saturday and Sunday the same. It was like,
yeah.
You know, when you have – I think if you have a passion for something and you love something, you don't count how much you actually – hours or time you actually do. You just do it. You don't realise how much you do. But looking back at it now, I'm going, you know what? It was pretty crazy.
Thousands of hours accumulated there.
It was crazy.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, fast forward, I'll mention obviously a couple of coaches or people that you've been associated with. Tommy Docherty. Tell us about Tommy.
Tommy was incredible. He came to the scene at Sydney Olympic and, you know, there was a big buzz. I mean, this is the guy that's coached Manchester United, coached Scotland. And all of a sudden, you know, we've got this huge figure in front of us coaching. It was incredible. Like, look, for me, he was great. I mean, he made me captain at 21.
Wow.
He said to me, I want you to wear my shirt, the number of my shirt. And he also gave me the greatest accolade. I was the best young player he ever worked with. It's like, what could I say?
Yeah.
It was huge. It was fantastic.
Well, how did you get – so we probably should have covered that the first bit. How did you get to Sydney Olympic?
I played at Canterbury Marrickville for 2 years.
Mm.
Then I went to St George.
Yep.
And I played there 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Sydney Olympic in 1981.
Right.
So and I had – yeah, like I had 4 years of first grade football before,
Right. Now, a question from the association's CEO, Ian Holmes.
Go Holmesy.
Yeah, here he is. Can you tell us about your pre-match warm-up regime?
Well, you know, Andy Pascalidis made me famous for that.
Right.
Look, it was different. You know, I had some unique ways to warm up. But look, it worked for me. And I'm quite happy to pass it on.
There we go. It'll be in the book eventually. The book eventually. Yeah. Now, again, we could be hours talking about this, but just your initial thoughts and what you're thinking at the time. Frank Arrock.
Look, Frank, what can I say about Frank? Frank, I mean, you know, I posted something the other last night about Frank.
Right.
He basically did the wrong thing in my career.
Right.
And the reason for that was because when I left St George and went to Sydney Olympic, after the first year at Sydney Olympic, he asked me to come back to St George because he said I was a St George, you know, junior or a player, and St George developed me.
Yeah.
And because I didn't go back, he basically the year that he took over as a national coach.
Right.
He basically, I was the first bloke that was gone from the national team.
Is that right?
And that's it saddens me to this day.
Wow.
Because look, I know he admired me as a footballer because he quoted many times in the press about what he thought of me as a player.
And to
be dumped like that because of a personal vendetta.
Yeah.
It was criminal, really.
Because how you had a number of appearances before that, didn't you?
Well, I did. I mean, yeah. I made 23, 24 appearances for Australia, and that was before him. And, you know, and I don't mind telling you, but 11 of those times where I was man of the match. And the thing is, to be dumped like that was like a kick in the teeth. But let me add something.
Yep.
You know, a lot of people support Frank Carrick and they think that he's great and whatever, mighty. But let me tell you, you know, the days when what he believed a footballer should be, you know, he liked the runners.
Yeah.
He liked the mad dog mentality.
Right.
He didn't embrace the footballer.
Right.
The artist, the technique guy. And unfortunately, that's when the start of the demise of Australian soccer started.
Yeah,
because all of a sudden we thought, well, this is the way, you know, we should be playing. We should be playing with physicality.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, if you look at the Asian countries today,
yeah.
Well, guess what? They've taken over. They've gone past us because skill and technique was the main things that, you know, Japan, you know, that we needed to embrace and improve and develop, not physicality.
No. Yeah, right.
And unfortunately, people didn't realize, but it's too late now.
Yeah.
We really need to
reinvent, reset
the wheel.
What was your – you obviously had some great moments there. Socceroos, what was your favourite moment or favourite game?
Well, favourite moment, it's easy. I played against England.
Yeah. So I was there.
You were there?
At the SCG. I was there.
Man of the match.
I was small, but I was there.
1993.
My dad took me to that.
That was an incredible game.
Yeah.
And, you know, I killed it that day and a very proud moment because, you know, we basically tested ourselves against probably the best – in the world, because at the time I was playing against the guy
John Barnes
was playing, but the guy in midfield was a guy Gordon Cowan. So he got transferred to I think Inter Milan. They bought him for about 10 million euros back in the day, and I'm playing against this guy, and you know, and I've taken him to the cleaners really, and so I for me it was to justify my ability.
Yeah.
In front of these caliber of players, you know, Luther Blissard, John Barnes.
Unbelievable.
You know, Williams, who was it? Trevor Francis, I think it was. Yeah. Peter Shilton.
Yes.
All these big name players.
Yeah. From your point of view, again, when you're growing up, I was small watching that game, but I remember the crowd, the buzz. It was capacity crowd, I'm pretty sure.
It was a lot of people there.
And it was buzzy. And do you find, again, you I'm sure you go to a lot of games now, has it changed, I mean, over the years in terms of the type of fan that comes to these games? Because do you find that
not really. I think that people have embraced the Socceroo brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the World Cup and the qualifications, I think, you know, the Socceroo brand is pretty huge, and I think there's a lot of following. Now, I can't say that it's any different. No, not really.
Okay. Then what happens? So after the so you miss out for what? How many years was it? I mean,
basically 83. I played against England. I played my first game Sydney Cricket Ground. I was man of the match. The second game I was taken off half time.
Yeah.
In Brisbane. The third game, Mr. Arok did not even play me.
Right.
And after that, he never selected me.
Is that right? Yep. And you couldn't challenge? Could you challenge it? There was no.
Well, I did. I personally did. But you know what? The problem was the press and people were too gutless to question Frank Arok. Frank Arok was a personality, and you know what? No one dared to challenge his basically decisions.
Mm.
They were too petrified of him.
Yeah. Wow.
To the detriment of Australian soccer, in my point of view,
I think
the game went backwards.
Is that right?
Yep.
So around that time, then you spent It was, I think, Sydney Olympic 1981 to 1984. Is that right?
81, 82, 83, 84,
84. 85. And 85, 86. I think you have a chance to go to Greece. Is that right? The homeland?
In the meantime, yeah. What I did is during that time I trialled for clubs in Greece, which, look, I was offered contracts. I basically didn't go because I wanted to play for Australia. Mm. I was young. Mm. I was 21 years old. You know, my head was everywhere.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. So young.
Yeah, look, I went to, Arsenal, like I said. I couldn't, I went to Olympiakos and they offered me a contract.
Wow.
I went to Panathinaikos, they offered me a contract in 82. So, look, I had opportunities, but unfortunately I didn't take them early. And then in 85 I decided, okay, I'll go to Larissa. In the meantime, before I left, I copped an injury. I copped a medial ligament tear, which I had to have an operation. I was out for 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
That put me back. I still went overseas.
Yeah.
Look, it was a difficult time for me.
Yeah.
A lot of politics in football. I was faced with different, environments that you never dreamed that would happen to you.
So,
but that's what happens, and I learn from that, and I pass on in my experiences to young players these days that want to sort of travel overseas and how they need to be prepared for the different environments they're faced.
Now, have you ever thought of the young Peter Catholis in 2020? What do you think? Again, thinking about the game where it is now, do you think where would you be?
I played now.
With the resources that we have now.
I would absolutely kill it because the days when we played Gilbert, we had a cricket pitch right in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the perfect billiard pitches to play. If I played in a pitch like that, I would absolutely, I'd be a different player because you could express yourself different ways. You could play those through boards that you back in my day, I'm thinking, okay, should I try this? I've got a divot here. Maybe I should just not play it now. I'll move one meter forward when there's a good patch of grass.
Unbelievable.
But that was the reality.
Yeah.
That's what we had to cope.
Yeah, unbelievable. Now, from that, so you then come back, Sydney Olympic again, is that right? You spend a bit of time there.
I go back to Sydney Olympic, yeah.
Then Apia Leichhardt. Now, Rally Rasic, tell us about Rally.
Yeah, Rally, look, 87, I was with Apia. Rally is basically given me a lifeline because I was told I wasn't required at Sydney Olympic one week before the NSL season started. So I was pretty lucky at that moment that I had people that believed in me and obviously Rally did, and he gave me a lifeline, which, I paid him back because we won the comp, and I was an integral part of that team.
Yeah. And you did just to confirm, at Sydney Olympic, you were very close, but you never won the championship. Is that right?
We won two cups, 85 and 84. We won the Southern – the Northern Division, and then we lost the final to South Melbourne.
Wow, okay. And then you go off to obviously you have some great spells at Marconi.
Well, we won, like I said, 87 we won the comp. Then next year I've gone to Marconi, and that was that was a great club. We call it the Palace. I still call it the Palace.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's everything there.
Yeah.
And we've won the comp in 88, 89, and I think 90 were runners up. So that was that was three championships in a row for me, and I was going for four, which would have been a record.
Yeah.
But I was pretty happy with that.
Who are the best again for the young listeners especially? Who are the? I'm sure some players that we'd know the names now.
Well, of course, look, Frank Farina was a great player. Tony Henderson, guys like Slucker and Nestevsky, great golf scorer. David Lowy, Bobby Catlin. Guys, Robbie Wheatley, Paul Carter, so many great players back in the day.
Yeah. So how old were you? Did you play on? I mean, in terms of that level, you played on pretty much.
Well, I played at Olympic, like I said, at Marconi. And then after Marconi, I've gone back to Olympic.
Yeah.
What's his name? I forget the coach there. Mickey Hickman.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've gone from there, I've gone to Melita, and that was my last club.
Right.
Which I, that was my NSL, I concluded my NSL career.
Right. What's your views on, again, I know it's hard to compare, A-League, NSL?
Look, we had individuals, you know, compared to what where we sure. had to play, there was better individuals, you know, in those grounds that we had to play. I mean, credit to all those guys, and I'm talking about Oscar Carino, Alan Davidson,
amazing,
Jarkov, you know, players that really, if they played in this day and age, they would absolutely kill it.
So just, and again, everyone's probably thinking, why, again, from your view, why were we producing players like that versus?
Look, it's a really good question, that one, because look, you know, personally, we have so much to offer. All these ex-players that that we reached a high level of football, but a lot of the ex-players are not involved in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically they haven't been encouraged to be involved in the game. You know, I mean, right. when you go to, they ask you to go get licenses. I mean, I did my B license. They want $4,000. A lot of players think, well, why should I go and pay $4,000? They should be asking me. And this is the issue. If we had more of the ex players to coach and develop young players, we would have a better product. You know, it's okay for seniors to have all these. People that really are not football people, you know, the argument is, oh, because you're an ex-footballer, it doesn't mean you're a good coach.
Yeah.
But the problem is, we've got a lot of these elite young players that haven't been handled by football people, football ex-footballers, and that is so important that they must be exposed to ex-footballers, because an ex-footballer will develop that player. A lot better than an academic.
Yeah, I know you're preparing something at the moment, but just give us an insight, your views on the coaching culture in Australia at the moment.
Well, look, it's all about money these days. You got money, you can get a license. If you got a license, you can coach. Hold on, because you've paid for a license. I mean, because you got a license to drive a car doesn't mean you're a good driver. So. You know, coaching, you know, that needs to be looked at. That needs to be, I think, reformed. The way we coach robots. Everyone complains and says, oh, we've got robots. Well, we have robots because we don't allow players to express themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my motto is play what you see.
Yeah.
Not what the book is telling you to do. Yeah. So the players are overcoached.
Right.
And they're scared to
robots, huh?
They're scared to make their own decisions because the coach is going to say, "Oh, why did you do that? I'm going to pull you off." So there's that factor. And look, a lot of people agree with that. Ex-footballers, they all agree that I think our players are it's too structured.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we need to basically make some changes.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of questions come through as well from the CDCFA as well. If you were the National Technical Director of the FFA, what would be your top three priorities?
Look, good question. I think I've covered them with, you know, the coaching. Yeah. The coaching education is the key, and I would get, you know, a lot more football people involved in the game.
Yeah.
And also the way we teach them. The way we teach them, we need to, you know, apply that freedom to express themselves.
Yeah,
I think that's the key, and I think we need to revise all these paperwork and all the books and manuals to reflect on that.
Well, going back to the NSL, from your opinion, who was the most, apart from yourself, the most technically gifted player, you think, in the former NSL competition?
Like I mentioned, I'll mention three guys. I think Oscar Carino, Alan Davidson, and Zarko Jarkov were right up there.
Top, eh? Yep. Fantastic. What was it like? Actually, I've just got a note here. You actually toured. Did you tour the UK? Is this right? You toured the UK.
Yes,
you played Manchester United at Old Trafford.
At Old Trafford.
Wow! Tell us about that experience.
Well, that was back in '91, and Tommy Doherty organised that.
Actually. Right.
Yeah, and we played Man United.
Jeez.
I remember what was his name? Hughes, McCarry. There was a few players there that.
Yeah.
It wasn't all.
This is wasn't.
It wasn't
their.
It wasn't
their golden time. No.
But it was a lot of the first grade squad players. Yeah. That, well. Look, we lost 2-1.
Jeez.
But look, it wasn't about the result for us. It was about being in that cauldron, being in that historic ground, and playing in Man United. I mean, we're the only club in Australia ever to do that. So it was
unbelievable, wasn't it? That's fantastic.
And I was captain.
Wow, how good's that?
It was great. Yes.
Playing at Old Trafford. Now, how you mentioned early on the Sydney Olympic and obviously the Marconi. How did you, in terms of your, obviously considering your Greek heritage, how did you feel when you had to play against Sydney Olympic in competition, obviously games, especially in the grand finals in the late 80s?
We played two. One we won and one we lost. So yeah. It was pretty square. But look, you know what? Look, I'm from a Greek background family. I enjoyed my time at Sydney Olympic.
Mm.
The thing is, I didn't choose to leave Sydney Olympic. They're the ones that made the decision to let me go.
Yeah.
So as a professional, I had to play with whatever team gave me an opportunity. And look, RB and Marconi were fantastic and I made a lot of friends. And until this day, I respect the clubs and the people involved so much.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, fast forward, I think you've had a very successful sporting business. You want to tell us about that?
Well, I started a business back in '83, I went for 37 years, so it was probably one of the longest retailing businesses in Australia. So I was pretty proud of that. I also bought out my own brand of boots and clothing and all sorts of things under Cape brand.
Yeah.
But look, we decided to wind that down. We decided to concentrate on other things because I got myself involved with property development and managing property and building. So I've sort of diverted to different areas in my life.
Mm, fantastic. Where do you see now? And I know you're still involved and you're very passionate, obviously, with football. Tell us about the Football Heritage Committee. You're on that as well, aren't you?
Yeah, look, they asked me to get involved and I was pretty happy to be a part. Look, the thing is, it's all about the history of the game.
Yep.
And I think that's something that we need people to know what happened back in the day.
Mm.
And it's a good thing, and hopefully all the material goes up on the net, which people can enjoy back in the 50s and the 40s and all those years and what happened in the 60s.
Yeah.
So I hope that we push ahead with that, and I hope it sort of serves its purpose.
Yeah. Where do you see the national team going over the next 10 years, let's say? 10 years.
Look, it's a good question because, look, we really have a problem with developing players, and unless we change it, I don't think we're going to make World Cups because the Asian countries are very strong, as we saw, and as we see, and they keep improving year after year. So, look, it's unless we have to really make a change, the way we produce players, and if you see the Japanese players, if you see the players in Indonesia or Malaysia or Thailand, you see the players are. Technically,
absolutely
good, they're improved, gifted. They're quick. And we really have to produce that sort of player, someone that's good, got good technique on the ball, no matter what position.
Yeah,
and have physical attributes, but he must also possess technique, just like the Japanese.
Good enough domestic coaches.
Well, look, we had the best.
Oh, Ange, of course,
we had the best.
Yeah,
and we decided. Not we. Certain people decided that, he wasn't really good enough. Unfortunately, they've got egg in their face because
the J League's fantastic, isn't it?
That bloke is an Australian. He played for Australia. He knows the culture, and obviously he knows how to coach. As he proved with the Japanese team, and you saw what happened when. His team, Yokohama, played against Sydney FC.
Mm.
Sydney FC was 15 points ahead and they've gone and played Yokohama. I couldn't believe it, what I was watching. But he's certainly a great coach. But look, you know, I questioned the appointment of Arnold. I thought that was, you know, he had a chance before, he failed. And I don't think anyone in the history of Australian soccer has had two opportunities, two bite of the cherry to get it right. So, yeah, that's my opinion.
If you could play against either current or old, a former international player, who would it be?
Wow. A former.
It could be a current or former. Yeah.
Look, I'd love to.
Well, you're wearing a Pelé jacket there. Let me give you a hint.
Actually, I pulled that out of the cupboard today. I've never worn.
Oh, here we go.
Look, yeah. Maradona's my favourite.
Maradona.
I'm wearing a Pelé jacket.
So that was going to be my next question. Who do you think is the greatest of all time?
Well, for me, Maradona was.
Why is that? Why Maradona? Is he technically better?
I like his individual qualities where, you know, he tried to beat one, two, or three or four players. I thought that was special. I mean, a lot of people, you know, don't see it that way. But any player that's got the confidence to be able to, you know, back himself and do that in such a small space and with the speed and skill and the creativity is.
Yeah.
Look, don't get me wrong. I think Pelé was an exceptional footballer.
Sure.
And we probably didn't see enough of Pelé because of TV. And the thing is, it's probably not a look. I saw Pelé. I did see Pelé, and I've seen him in videos. And look, he was a great footballer. But he
not week in week out like Ronaldo.
He didn't have what for me Maradona. I mean the other debate is now we've got Maradona.
It's
Messi,
hard to compare, Arnold, isn't it? The generations,
Ronaldo, whatever. But you know they're all great players. But look, personally, I like the individual that you know looks at a player and he says, you know, I'm going to take you on. I'm going to beat you. For me, that's the player that's basically missing in world football.
Right.
And whoever does that is worth big bucks.
Yeah, right.
And people are paying big money.
Yeah. Who do you think was our greatest Socceroo?
Our greatest Socceroo?
Yeah.
Look, it's a toss-up between two. Look, I personally, you know, like Mark Viduka. Mark Viduka is an exceptional footballer, which was smart. Scored a lot of goals. You know, Timmy Cahill is also another great player that served the country in a big way. Oh, look, it's a toss-up between these two. I mean, then there's Harry Kewell behind the scenes, but I think that out of those two, I really can't pick. I can't pick.
It's hard
to pick. But I'd say first two would be those two.
Yeah. Within the association, a lot of other associations follow the same, I guess, formula. Small-sided football when the juniors, you know, under sixes, under sevens, they've got the small goals. I mean, I remember as well playing. And when I was under six, I was at Lambert Park just kicking the ball and I had no idea, where the ball was. What's your view on small-sided football versus just playing the full field and
that's important.
Growing into important. It? Yeah.
I mean, look, I played a lot of that.
Yeah.
I played in the playground, which was a lot of small spaces. I played in the gym, that was small spaces. So I learned how to deal with, you know, tight environments and how to get out of tight situations.
Yeah.
So, you know, playing in a tight area, you know, you're more touches with the ball.
Yeah.
And your decision making to get out of situations. I mean, I still play till this day in small games, but. Because it's very enjoyable because you get a lot more touches. So for kids, it's crucial that they play in such small areas because that's how you get more touches. And eventually, as you get a little bit older, you're trying to find solutions how to get out of tight areas.
Yeah. What's another current issue that's happening is obviously the cost of playing football. What's your view on that? I mean, I know in Europe, for instance, there are arguments that, you know, it's peanuts pretty much if you –
Look, the problem here is that we don't. It starts from the top.
Yeah,
You know, people don't understand. It's government funding.
Yep.
We don't get enough money from the government. And someone's got to lobby.
Yeah.
And ask the government. Look, you know, we have so many participants compared to every other sport.
Biggest participant.
Why are we getting less than everyone else? That's number one. Number two. I mean, if we got all this money, more money, then we'd be able to subsidise the clubs and the grassroots and the parents and whatever. But look, at the end of the day, look, it does cost money you know, for your kit,
yep,
your grounds, you know, paying referees to run a soccer club. You know, there's a figure there. Look, should it be what they're charging? No, it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, football these days is – there's a lot of people that try to make money out of the game. And unfortunately, until we start curbing that, you know, we will have problems. So, look, Australian soccer is facing a few problems, and but the thing is I think we need a collective you know, input to try to see and find solutions how to make it better.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned coaching. When you've obviously travelled around the world, but what else are we missing apart from that coaching culture? Is it only the – is it really just the coaching culture, or are there other elements missing in this train?
Well, I think – look, look, a lot of people say, look, you know, the players haven't got the heart. You know, the thing is – well, I think that's instilled in them. If somebody really loves the game, if you're a coach and you love what you do and you do it with passion, you're going to instill that – that passion and love into that kid that's growing up and whatever.
Yeah.
So again, I think it's the coaching, and the thing is, why can we say clubs, A-League clubs, go to the grassroots coaches or clubs and say, look, here's 200 tickets. Give it to the parents, take your kids and come to the A-League game to build a connection. You know, where the kids can aspire to some player where they'll look up and say, oh, I want to be like Moy. I want to be like Nick Cull or Peter Catholos or whoever.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, well, that's the way it was. The kids used to come to the games and they used to aspire to be, you know, like one of us.
Now, you continue to play the game. You played in over 35s, over 45s.
I played
over 45. Tell us about that experience. What does that feel compared to when you're playing at 21?
Well, mate, you know, everyone still wants to kick me, kick my ass. But the thing is, you know, and they still think I'm going to do what I used to do at 21, but unfortunately that's not the case. We're a lot slower these days. We're just happy to have a run and have a kick and have a laugh.
Are you still playing now? No, you're not still playing. Well, I've just
had
right?
I have had a hip replacement, but I'm trying to get back on track this year.
Where do you see your involvement in the game over the next few years? What would you like to do?
I don't know. Look, many people ask me that question. I mean, look, I do one-on-one coaching these days, and I do specialist coaching for kids that are basically good footballers that they want to make a career out of the game. So I'm giving them that finesse or that finishing touch. You know, I'm not trying to advertise myself.
No. Of course.
You know, I've got parents that ring me and ask me if I can help them with their kids because they need. Well, they're not any advice, but they need mentoring. They need to see what they need to improve and how to go about it.
Yeah.
So I do that and I enjoy that. And look, as far as I've got myself involved in this football coaching reform, which look, I'm actually, you know, it's a big challenge, and I'm looking forward to producing something. So I want to make a contribution in another way, and that's. This is the way I can do it. I can galvanise the football family. And where we get together to help the game.
So if you can say right, these are the outcomes I want out of that. Well, what would that be?
Well, look, I'm talking to people, you know, all day for the last week, and everyone's calling me, you know, ex players and
is that right?
Ex Socceroos captains, national coaches, technical directors, you name it.
Yeah.
And we're discussing different issues.
Yeah.
You know, there's different pillars. The game is made up of, you know, the administration, the governance, the marketing, development, you know, all sorts of areas where we need to look at and try to improve. You know, we need to improve every one of those areas. And look, it's a time where we need to embrace everybody.
Yeah.
We're not pointing the fingers. No one's going to be pointing the fingers at anyone saying, oh, you know, you're no good or, you know, you're not doing a good job. It's not about that. It's about, you know, giving direction.
Yeah.
How do we improve and make the product better? Right through the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, our document is going to every Football Federation committee.
Wow.
It's going to FFA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that can't be ignored because it's from the football people. It's not – they can't – you know, we have so many people involved that – that are reputable people. It's not, it's not coming from Peter Catholos. Where they can say, oh, but, you know, he's having a good go.
You're the mate,
because, but I – look, I'm very, very, very happy the way it's going and hopefully hopefully we can make an impact.
Oh, fantastic. Now, you've got the nickname Cat. Tell us I think that was given to you by the Sydney Olympic supporters. Is that right? Or where did that come from? No, tell us where that came.
That came from – I'll tell you the guy. His name is Ian Rowden.
Right.
He was the captain of the Young Socceroos back in the day when we toured Paraguay.
Okay.
And, you know, he started me calling me Cat, and so that's –
Is that it?
Stuck from then.
Right. Fantastic.
And it's with a K.
It's with a K. Exactly right. What's the best advice you've been given? Oh, I'm sure you've been given a lot of good advice, but what's the best one? You reckon you still hold to this day?
I think my parents, you know, my parents' advice and the ethics they've taught me, you know, to be, you know, to make it in life and to, you know, the way where I've come from and where I've ended up being, you know, I embrace. All those things that they installed on me and I applied to them in whatever I do. And it's hard work. It's respecting people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously, you know, communication with everybody to reach a result.
Fantastic. What advice would you give to, some of our younger listeners who are probably, you know, playing under 13s, under 14s, at the cusp with deciding, like, what do I do next? Where do I go?
Look, it's easy. You know, if you're a young player,
you
know, what do you want to do? Do you want to play soccer just for fun?
Yeah.
Well, you just keep playing for fun if you enjoy it. But if you're serious about wanting to make it as a footballer and play overseas, which by the way, we have got a lot of talented players, which they can. They can. Well, you know, they need to work hard.
Yeah.
They need to be coached by the right people. And be refined by the right people. And once you get that right, you got to have a chance to because let me tell you, Gilbert, I see a lot of players.
Yeah.
And that although they're talented, there's something missing. And those little points are the points that matter when you want to go and make it in an overseas club because they're – If you and I touch on this, a player wants to go overseas. Somebody needs to analyze: are you good enough? Somebody needs to prepare him.
Yeah,
where he's going to go, what environment he's going to go. He's got to be ready mentally, psychologically, physically, technically, and then you know off he goes. I don't think that happens enough. So a lot of kids think, oh, you know, I'll go overseas and try my luck. Well, you know,
it's not good enough.
Well, you've got to be ready. And someone really needs to prepare you for that journey. A lot of players go and they all come back and they're all disillusioned. So you got to be careful who you're dealing with, the player as a player, your manager, your coach. You know that network is important. Your support system, is important to make it as a footballer. But look, let me tell you. There's a lot of players that are very talented. I've
knocking on the door, huh?
They're knocking the door, and it's a shame. It's a shame that we just can't get them over the line because they're not handled by the right people.
Right. Unbelievable.
That's my
there we go.
That's my advice.
Terrific. That's been great, Peter. Just one final question. If you had one wish, what would it be?
Wow. Look, I lost my son at 13. I wish he was still alive today. Little Jason, I lost him at 13 through cancer. And you know, those things in life make you very, very strong. And you know, I changed as a human being because of that. And you know, So I wish, I wish he was still alive today.
That's beautiful. Thanks very much for your time, Peter.
You're welcome.
Thank you.